Hiya, Duncan Green here with the latest roundup of posts on From Poverty to Power. I am absolutely exhausted. Not because of the end of term, not because it's almost Christmas, but because my first granddaughter, my first grandchild appeared about a week ago. And that's lovely, and she's gorgeous, and I'm over the moon. But our contribution was to look after the parents' crazy dog. So we've been dog sitting for a week. A very needy spaniel who has to do things like come to the shower with me, otherwise he cries. And I feel like I've got a new baby, only less fun. So on the other hand, he does look great when he's running for a ball, which babies don't. So, he's going back home today. Everything's quietening down. I am looking forward to some peace and quiet. Anyway. Big moments these, you know, first grandchild and all that, all very exciting. Her name's Cora, by the way, and she's gorgeous. Right, back to the business. Links I liked, M. Berry wrote a poem which was tweeted by Jayati Ghosh, actually, I think, Because of Us. And I thought it was rather lovely. It's about Gaza. This morning I learned that the English word gauze, finely woven medical cloth, comes from the Arabic word, Gaza, because Gazans have been skilled weavers for centuries. I wondered then how many of our wounds have been dressed because of them, and how many of theirs have been left open because of us. Power of poetry. Very, very beautiful, beautiful and haunting. Next post. And this is, we've got a couple of weeks post to get through here. Post about some work that UN Women are doing, which is very interesting. Bafflingly, I was recently invited to an online expert group meeting to help UN Women flesh out a really important new strategy, making norm change central to its role. This strikes me as both exciting and scary. Exciting because a lot of the players in the AIDS development social change sector are starting to take norm change seriously, which I think is an important recognition of a vital driver of social and political progress. Scary because although post-Brexit vote and hopefully post-Trump, progressive activists realise that they got too bogged down in the details of policy advocacy, new laws, etc., etc., and were blindsided by big populist norm-based movements, we're only just scratching the surface on how to do norm change, how to intentionally shift norms in a progressive direction. My gut feeling is that to do this well, we may have to jettison many of the approaches and organising models of traditional advocacy. But it will be fascinating to see what UN Women conclude on this. There are a lot of academic papers commissioned for the discussion, which will all be published in due course by UN Women. The one that stood out for me was How Does Change Happen? Social Norms, Religion and Family Laws in the MENA Region by Marwa Sharafeldin, an Egyptian visiting fellow at Harvard. It's still in draft form, but here are some excerpts with Marwa's permission. Looking closely at Muslim family laws in the MENA region, we find an underlying philosophy and worldview on gender relations that has its origin in a patriarchal human reading of Islamic religious texts, as opposed to a more egalitarian reading of these very same texts. Today, these laws are mostly premised on a man-made juristic equation created by classical jurists over hundreds of years, whereby, simply put, a man is obliged to provide financial maintenance in return for obedience by the woman. This patriarchal juristic reading of Islam's sacred texts is still alive and kicking in the majority of contemporary Muslim family laws and practices, legitimating male guardianship and authority over women, and lots of other things like gender-based violence. Whether this was the intent of the sacred texts or not, for now, this equation with its hierarchical view of gender relations remains the linchpin upon which most of the contents of Muslim family laws, norms, and gender relations are premised. There is, however, a reformist gender discourse that takes gender justice and equality as the premise of gender relations in Islam. It finds that gender inequalities found in the traditional discourse are not divine injunctions, but rather are human constructions created by male jurists that contradict the divine intent of Islam's message. It is a discourse that deconstructs religious knowledge, focusing on how knowledge was produced in order to reconstruct an alternative knowledge that comes closer to the purposes of Sharia. The question here is, despite the presence of both a traditional and a reformist Islamic discourse on gender relations, both rooting themselves in the sacred texts, why was one made more dominant than the other in our day-to-day lives? What we end up with, in fact, is a political question, not merely a theological one. The demarcating lines between politics and religion become significantly blurred when state institutions, including religious ones, purposefully pick up a particular religious discourse and endorse it in their laws and policies regulating society and its gender norms. It is this co-optation of religion by politics to serve certain interests that has made Muslim family laws and norms particularly resistant to reform. How should UN women think about change in this kind of context? And Sharaf Eldon here provides a great case study of Musawa, which is a global movement for equality and justice in the Muslim family, which was launched in Malaysia in 2009. I won't go into details on Musawa, but it's got some really good theory of change. It works with activists, policymakers, parliamentarians, judges, lawyers, young women and men, provides a space for mobilizing and organizing on both local and religious and regional levels, and campaigns on things like the Campaign for Justice in Muslim Family Law. And it's been successfully adapted in numerous other countries, including India, Indonesia, South Africa, and Egypt. The paper concludes with some excellent thoughts on measurement. In brief, she identifies three levels that can each be measured with a high degree of rigor. Changes in religious public discourse on religion and gender, changes in laws and policies, and changes in the lived realities of women and families in Muslim contexts. So that's a really good start. This whole process is going to be really interesting and was definitely worth the discomfort of being the only participating male in a 50-plus UN Women webinar. Next post couldn't be more different. What's it like explaining NGOs to senior military types from 40 countries? I got a grilling from an unusual audience for me last week. 100-plus senior military officers, colonels and above, from 40 countries attending what amounts to a UK-sponsored military masters, my words, a year-long course on strategy for future military leaders. I can't be more specific because it was the Chatham House rule. My task was to introduce them to their wonderful world of NGOs. I'll spare you the general introduction and pick up on the last few slides on the challenges of civilian-military coordination, a big topic for both sides, especially in a range of humanitarian settings where soldiers are involved both in fighting and increasingly in helping civilians. And I got hold of a really useful 2012 literature review by the Humanitarian Policy Group at the ODI. It'd be great if they could update it. It's over 10 years old now. But it identified some of these challenges. Blurred lines. If soldiers are taking part in humanitarian activities like handing out food or medicines, or aid workers are hitching rides on military vehicles or helicopters, it can easily lead to the two being conflated, especially by armed actors, as they're known, with serious risks to humanitarian workers and partners. Mutual distrust. With such different cultures and values, it's easy for each side to other each other. Useless bleeding hearts versus trigger-happy thugs. One ex-soldier told me, military types often struggle to see NGOs as anything other than potential force multipliers. Poor coordination, not just between NGOs and the military, but within NGOs and within militaries. In really big emergencies, the militaries of different countries don't always coordinate with each other, but neither does the influx of NGOs. So it can be just very chaotic, especially in a fast-moving, messy crisis. It's just an enormous mess, in other words. Expanding military remits. In recent years, militaries have got more involved in humanitarian response itself, sometimes as a part of a wider effort to win hearts and minds. So back to the blurred lines. Next, underestimating the role of national militaries. This one was interesting. In places like Pakistan, the main role in responding to major weather events like the terrible floods we've seen recently is played by the Pakistani military. But both the international soldiers and the INGOs sometimes fail to grasp this. Incompatible aims. The military pursues stability and the INGOs pursue respect for human rights. Sometimes the two overlap, but not always. And then cultural differences such as language. Protection means very different things, as far as I can work out. For NGOs, it means protecting almost any right. So it basically means everything. For soldiers, it's more about protection from injury or death. Hierarchy. Militaries like them, NGOs don't, even when they still have them. Process. See hierarchy. Militaries focus on outcomes. NGOs also worry a lot about how you get there. And I was told to keep it light, so I had a happy half hour trying to summarise the basic difference between governments, militaries and NGOs. It's a bit tongue-in-cheek, but it got people going and got people talking. So, yeah, I'll just take a couple of the rows. Reputation. Reputation of governments, low. Reputation of militaries, high, mostly, but not in Myanmar or Thailand. NGOs, high for now, but it's politics. Governments are under pressure, populism. Militaries are pretty insulated from politics. NGOs are definitely under attack all over the world. Decision-making, complex in governments. Multiple poles of power, lots of, you know, negotiations. Militaries, interesting, they're vertical, but with autonomy at the local level. So soldiers in the battlefield allowed to get on with it to quite a large extent. And in NGOs, I'm afraid I just said decision-making is occasional, and quite a few people thought that was funny. Use of violence, governments in extremis, militaries, it's core business, it's what they do, and the NGOs find it very hard to accept a positive role for violence. So the lecture lasted 45 minutes, but the Q&A was an hour. Very, very interesting. They use Slido, as all very tech-savvy, these military types, and that allows you to cluster questions and seem to curtail this urge for more of a comment than a question speeches. So I was quite impressed by that. The questions were friendly on how NGOs work, how they prioritise, the role they play in electoral democracies, but lots on ethics and integrity. I felt really challenged through a lot of it. It was really good. So I enjoyed this, and I left wondering if we should be having more such conversations. So I think if they ask me back, I will definitely be going. Next post, again, couldn't be more different. Feminist climate justice. What is it and how could it help? And this is a guest post from three researchers at UN Women. It was part, yeah, they followed up after the expert group meeting I mentioned earlier. Laura Turquette, Silke Staab, and Constanza Tabusch. Could feminist thinking unlock some of the logjams that continue to frustrate action on the scale and speed that we need to avoid catastrophe? In a new paper by UN Women, Feminist Climate Justice, A Framework for Action, we outline what the term feminist climate justice means and how it can be operationalized to ensure that gender inequalities can be addressed alongside climate change. We identify four dimensions of justice for policy action on climate change and gender equality. First, climate policies must recognize women's rights, labor, and knowledge. Second, there is a need to redistribute resources away from male-dominated environmentally harmful economic activities towards those prioritizing women's work, regeneration, and care for both people and ecosystems. Third, it is crucial to equally represent the voices of women and other marginalized groups in environmental decision-making. Fourth, to repair historical injustices involves acknowledging the Global North bears the largest share of responsibility for historical emissions. So there we are, four R's: recognize, redistribute, represent, and repair. In addition to the what of feminist climate justice, the paper argues that the process of how do we get there is equally important. The massive gap between the demands for bold climate action and sluggish government responses raises urgent questions on how to ensure accountability. There are no easy answers, but strengthening democratic institutions and spaces in which the diverse demands of women and other historically marginalized groups are taken seriously is an area that we cannot afford to ignore. So the paper is the first installment and conceptual framework of the next edition of UN Women's flagship report, Progress of the World's Women, which I always really enjoy. And the next one, which will come out in 2025, is on gender equality in the age of climate crisis. Also, I've also produced a paper, which I didn't have time to review, What Would a Feminist Loss and Damage Fund Look Like? So interesting coming together of feminist thinking and climate change thinking all around the Dubai COP, the COP in COP 28 in the United Arab Emirates. Next post was about one of the big new superstars on the global stage, Mia Mottley, Prime Minister of Barbados. She gave an amazing speech at the LSE last week. Tickets were hot items. I managed to get in. And she talked about everything, but among other things, she talked about slavery, poverty, George Floyd, climate, and the future of the world. It was outgoing Oxfam CEO Dani Shiskandaraja who got her to come, but she was very happy to come because she'd studied at the LSE back in the day. I think she did a law degree of some kind. And it was hosted by another great group of people, the LSE's International Inequalities Institute. So first, the vibe. It was jaw-dropping because of the performance, really. The structure was amazing. So it wasn't just Motley giving a speech. She came with Barbados's poet laureate, Esther Phillips, and they syncopated. So Esther Phillips would read a poem, and then I think Motley was kind of improvising, at least partly, she didn't seem to have notes, improvising on the poem. And then at the end, she did a sort of grand sweep piece. So there were poems on slavery, reparations, but also the need to heal and come together to deal with common challenges like poverty and the climate crisis. It reminded me of Obama, that ability to, those big sweeping oratorical horizons, uplifting, leaving you feeling part of something bigger than yourself. And I was just thinking, wow, UN Secretary General material here. Should she actually want to do such a thankless job? You know what? I'm not going to actually read out her words because I just could not do it justice. She was brilliant. She speaks beautifully. What I did was stick it into Descript, which generates, it's an AI program which generates a very good transcript, edited it down to blog length. But even in written form, it doesn't do justice to the power of her performance. And I certainly couldn't by trying to read it out. So I urge you to go and the links to both the audio and the video are there. Do go and check it out. It was a beautiful evening and one I will remember for a very long time. Final blog of the week. Lucy Gray asked in comments for some recommended reads for last minute presents. So book recommendations, right? Be careful what you wish for, Lucy. So I use five criteria to justify a completely personal selection. Books that changed my life, and in 2015 I gave a lecture in Barcelona on that, and I linked to the lecture. Huge fun. Barcelona on St. George's Day have this tradition. It's very sexist but also very bookish, that every man gives the woman in his life a book and every woman gives the man in her life a flower. I think that's breaking down. I certainly hope so. So anyway, from that lecture, the books that changed my life. The books that have made it to my special shelf. I have one shelf in my bookshelf where, you know, the ones I keep going back to are. And I've got a picture of that if you want to look further. The best reads from the last couple of years, because recency matters a bit. Books that are readable. You know, after all, these are Christmas presents, so you don't want to inflict. I didn't recommend Piketty's Capital. I don't think that's a fair Christmas present, for example. It's about 1,000 pages or something. And painfully, no books by me. You know, this is, I mean, I'm not known for authorial reticence, but I think on this occasion, you know, fair dues. But I'm not going to read you the links because I think that's enough on the podcast for this week. And you're going to have to visit the blog for the links. But they are very good books. If you're desperately looking around for a last minute stocking filler, something to stick under the tree for a geeky relative, I think it might be worth you checking these out. Okay, you probably won't hear again from me before Christmas. Have a good break if you're having a break. Have a good Christmas if you're having a Christmas. Have a good New Year if you're having a New Year. See you on the other side in 2024. Bye.